Okay, we are recording. It is May 9th, 2022. This is Jen Brown. I'm here on the island in Corpus Christi, Texas, and I'm speaking with Cookie Cooper on the Baffin Bay Oral History Project. So, to start, do I have your permission to record?
Yes, for
Okay,
sure.
thank you. Okay, well, since this is an oral history, can you tell me more about your background and early life?
Well, I was an Air Force brat. I've lived everywhere. And our last station before moving down to Texas, we were stationed in Limestone, Maine. And up there was a lot of fly fishing, freshwater fly fishing, small trout, and maybe a smallmouth bass here or there. And when we moved to Texas, I knew this is where I needed to be. So, when my family left and went to Sault Ste. Marie, Michigan, I stayed here. In fact, at that point in time, I was going to go to the University of Delaware because that's where all my mother's family's from. And I got down here and I said, well, I think I'm just going to stay here. But it was 1966, which was the heat of the Vietnam War. So I went to, enter into the University of Texas. My mom drove me up there and had the grades to get in, but at that time you had to live on campus and they didn't have any rooms. They were full. So I said, fine. So we're heading back to San Antonio and I see this sign that says Southwest Texas State Teachers College. Mom, pull it here, pull in here. So we pulled in, same deal. Grades were fine, but they had no rooms and all the freshmen had to stay on campus in the dorms. I said, well, we don't have any room, but we'll call you. If something opens up and we find a place we can get you in, we'll sure do it. So I was already making my reservation, plane reservation to fly back to Delaware to go to school up there. And we get the call. They said, well, we have a room for you, but you may not be comfortable there because it's not air conditioned. I said, it doesn't matter. I mean, this is August. So I head up there and I hadn't been here but a few weeks and I had no idea how hot it could be in a dorm with no air conditioner and just a little bitty fan. Anyway, I got in and they told me if we get a better room, we've got Reed Hall, which is a nice new air conditioned, brand new, and if somebody drops out of there, we'll put you over there. I said, okay. So I suffered through that for a couple of weeks and just about at the point where I wanted to give up. And they said, telephone rings in the dorm. We didn't have cell phones back then. And they said, you have a room at Reed Hall. Believe me, Jen, I couldn't get out of that dorm I was in fast enough. Got over to Reed Hall. From then on, life was wonderful. My family wasn't affluent or anything, so I worked three jobs, worked my way through high school. I was underwater gardener at Aquarina. You probably don't know what that is. It's in San Marcos. But anyway, it's a major attraction down here. And worked in a gas station, and I was a proctor at the San Marcos Baptist Academy. From then, I got my business degree, started my own business, been self-employed ever since, and I'm a certified real estate appraiser at this point in my life. Spent a little stint in the oil field and did really well and made a lot of money, and then the collapse came and I lost a lot of money, and then it got really good again, and then it went down again. And the third time when it went up, I got out. I made a little money and bought a house down here. And that's pretty much, since I've gotten here, I love it. It's where I'm supposed to be, and I don't want to live anywhere else in the world. I've lived a lot of places being an Air Force brat.
What did you like about Texas so much that you didn't want to leave?
The freeness of it, the openness of it, the entrepreneurship down here. I mean, a lot of our stations were on the East Coast, and pretty much on the East Coast, everything is related to the union. Pretty much all of my friends up there and all the people that I know that are still up there, my sister still lives in Delaware, they work for a company. It's a corporation arena. Where down here, It's free spirited. If you decide you want to go try to do something and make a living creating something new, get after it. And people will encourage you and sometimes even financially support you. So, and just the weather, I mean, I had enough snow living in Maine for 3 years that it wouldn't hurt my feelings if I never saw a snowflake again. But, and just the people are a lot friendlier, I guess, because it gets so cold on the East Coast, everybody's bundled up and they're moving fast. They just, we're down here, everybody just has a lot more laid back attitude. They're more relaxed, they're friendlier, and they're just more fun for me. I mean, when I go home to see my sister, it's just different. People up there, a lot of them don't even know their next door neighbors, you know. So I love it here. I'm in paradise.
Mm-hmm. And did you grow up hunting and fishing?
Absolutely. And it's really kind of odd because my father didn't fish. My father hunted a little bit. We did a little bit of deer hunting. He loved to squirrel hunt. He was born in Elkins, West Virginia, so he grew up in the country. And the reason he left Elkins, West Virginia is because he saw everybody in his family went to work for the coal mine. And it's just as soon as he was big enough to get on a bus and get out of Elkins, West Virginia, he got in the Air Force. Anyway, yeah, a little bit of that, but my brothers don't fish, either one of them. My sister doesn't fish. I just got the bug, you know, from when I was in elementary school. That's all I wanted to do was read books about fishing.
Who taught you how to fish?
Ooh. Well, I can tell you that my earliest experience with fishing, we had a house that was on a creek. I was probably five. I was 4 or 5, and my buddies and I would take safety pins and a little piece of string and a stick, and we would go fishing the creek and catch perch. Every now and then we'd catch one. So I don't know if anybody actually ever taught me how to fish. I mean, I've fished with some really good fishermen that I watched what they did, and they'd say, do this or do that, or, you know, look at this, look at that. But as far as having somebody that mentored me or kind of took me by the hand, said, let's go fishing, I did have a friend of my mother's had a brother that took me fishing a couple of times. And he was a bass fisherman. We used to fish with, they made their own corks back then out of wood, and they would use shiners that were probably 6 inches long, trying to catch the biggest bass in Alabama, Georgia, or whatever. So that was pretty much it. But, you know, once the bug bit me, there was no getting away from it.
And what sort of fishing did you do when you moved down to Texas?
I started bass fishing. We moved to San Antonio, and there were a lot of lakes around. And for probably 14 years, that's all I did was bass fishing. Moved to Gonzales. I got married in school and moved to Gonzales. And met a friend up there named Bruce McKee, who's an excellent fisherman. He's a hardhead, but he and I have been fishing together for 52 years now. We haven't killed each other yet. And he and I would just fish every lake around. There's several small lakes around Gonzales. And then we'd start branching out, and we'd go a little farther and a little farther, and you know, it wouldn't be unlike us to work until 5 or 6 o'clock on Friday, load up the boat and head out, sleep in the truck, go fishing the next morning, sleep in the truck, fish Sunday morning, and head home. And in fact, when we got bass fishing, we actually started saltwater fishing. That's kind of, we got the bug for saltwater. We just fell in love with speckled trout and, you know, the floundering and the redfish and all of that. And so we would get off work. We had a little flounder boat. We had to be back at church Sunday for the wives. So we would get off of work. We'd run down to the coast, sometime in the middle of the week even. We'd flounder all night. We'd come back, clean the flounder, clean up, go back to work. But we were a lot younger then. We could do that. I couldn't do that anymore.
Or make it back in time for church. Wow. So do you remember the first time you saltwater fished or fished in Baffin Bay?
The first time I ever saltwater fished, I had met some guys at Gonzales, and they were going down, and there was kind of an old legend over in Rockport named Alvy Wyatt. And Alvy was Jay Watkins' mentor. I mean, Alvy was probably one of the greatest red fishermen that ever lived. But he knew all of it. He knew all the trout and everything, but that's all he did. I mean, he had a little store there, and he would fish, and, you know, they would sell fish back in those days. In fact, anybody that caught fish, you could take them to him, and he would buy them. He just wanted to gut it and gild, and he paid, back then, 50 cents a pound, I believe it was. So some of my friends, he was originally from Gonzales, and some of my friends in Gonzales knew him well, so when we'd go down there, we'd all fish together, and I learned a lot from him. I mean, he was, if I ever had a teacher or a mentor in saltwater fishing, it would be Alvy Wyatt. I mean, he was an incredible man. Back then, we'd go fishing, and for all day fishing, Jen, he would take a can of sardines, one of those little flat can of sardines, a little pack of saltine crackers, and then his fishing lures, he would have only everybody, well, he fished bait, but most of the time he fished with lures. He went in his pocket. They didn't have any Ziploc bags or anything like that back then, so they used to have these kind of plastic tobacco holders for pipe tobacco that had a roll up on the end that you kind of could secure. He had that little thing in his left shirt pocket, and he would have like four lures in there. He'd have a couple of 52 M28 mirror lures and maybe two or three gold and silver spoons. That was it. And you talk about a man that's gotten into some storms. He fished mostly over there, Copano Bay, Rockport, Cedar Bio, Carlos, Mesquite Bays. And he's dumped that little 13-foot whaler over many a time because he would just go by himself and head out in Copano Bay. And, of course, back then, you know, when you were going fishing, you didn't pay as much attention to the weather as we do now. And he'd get off in a storm, turn it over, but he survived. And I think Alvy was probably up in his 70s whenever he passed away, but he was a character. I had another fella named Charlie Stella from Gonzales, that he and I made a trip to Mexico, just the two of us, going down there to fish at La Pesca. He told me so many stories about when they used to go to Third Pass, Eighth Pass, all that down out of Brownsville and everything. And he and his buddy Glenn Story had an airplane. And so what they would do is, and I know this is hard to comprehend nowadays because of the scarcity of fish, but in those days, the guys, they had a group, and like four or five of them would go in an Army Deuce and a Half, which is one of those great big trucks that you see all the soldiers sitting in the back of. They would go down the beach somehow, or down the shoreline, and Charlie and Glenn would take that little tail dragger airplane, and they would fly down the coast. They'd actually tie their fishing rods up under the struts on the plane, fly down the coast. And when they saw those redfish, they could tell those guys, no cell phone, none of that, no radios. But they could go over and tell those guys, you know, they're going to be wherever you're at. Because they pre-planned, you know, we're going to stop here and we'll wait here for you. Fly down and get down there. And those fish would run, I guess, in a pattern and in a certain direction. And it took them however much time to get there. They could land that plane and tell them, that big school of redfish is going to be here tomorrow or later today or whatever. There were that many of them. I mean, the water, they told me it would just be red for just as far as you could see, just redfish upon redfish. So anyway, they do that and get those redfish and load them up, fillet them, bring them back home, and, you know, be able to feed their families for the rest of the year.
Yeah.
And, Charlie was, these guys were way ahead of their time. I mean, they had an airboat, they built themselves before they really had airboats. And Charlie Stella, one of the guys that went in the airplane, took his airboat out, and they were at the Port Aransas jetties, took it out, everything was fine. And then when he was coming back in, the tide changed and had the big waves. That was when his airboat took a dive to the bottom of the channel right there at the jetties. He never built another airboat, but he made it.
What year did you start fishing the coast?
I started fishing the coast in 1970. And we went from bass fishing to trout fishing.
What was it like back then?
Well, I think the three biggest things, I had a little house in Port O'Connor, a little fishing camp. And at that point in time, there were just so few people, and there were so many fish, and the water was so green, just beautiful. I guess that's the biggest thing. You know, when I was in Port O'Connor, there were just, if there were a couple hundred, 300 houses, that was probably it. So those are the biggest changes. More people, less fish. The water's not as pretty.
What about Baffin Bay? Do you remember the first time you fished down there?
Yes. And actually the first time I fished down there, it's considered the Baffin Bay area, Rocky Slough, you probably heard of that, or Penescal Point or whatever. Well, at that point in time, we didn't have a big enough boat to come down from Corpus, you know, Marker 37 or someplace like that, and head south, because, I mean, that was an all-day deal. We had a lot smaller motors, and instead of taking 30 minutes like these guys can now with these 70, you know, run 70, 80 miles an hour, back then we'd plug along at 20, 25 miles an hour. So we didn't even have a boat. I didn't have one, none of my friends had one, but I had a riverboat, it was 18-foot flat bottom aluminum boat with a 20-horsepower motor. So we decided what we would do. Everybody had a four-wheel drive truck because all my friends were rednecks. We were all rednecks. Lived in the country, you know, our thing to do in the country was go hunting or go fishing. That was it. So we put that 18-foot flat bottom with that 20-horsepower Mercury, which back then Mercuries didn't run as well as they run now. They weren't really a saltwater motor. And we drove down here, and then we drove out there to Padre Island National Seashore, and we went all the way down the beach, and there was a little trail you could go over between the dunes and get to Yarborough. I don't know whether you've ever been down there. You've been down there?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Anyway, so we'd take that flat bottom, go over there, put the boat in, and then we'd head across and go straight over to it, pretty much kind of right across from Rocky Slough out in there, Penescal. We'd go out in there and then we'd go out. We'd get a little bit into Baffin Bay, but with that little flat bottom, we didn't go very far. And then we'd get back, and then, of course, the wind would come up, and it'd be a lot rougher going home than coming back. We did that several times. I mean, we'd go down, get off work, go down there, camp out at that little spot where the little tables and things are, go fishing, come back, spend the night again, fish the next morning, go home. That was my first experience. My first experience actually coming out of Corpus. My friend Tom Sanders, father-in-law, Bill Sharp, and his buddies had a cabin right there across from Twin Palms, right across from the Badlands and all that, on the east side of the intercoastal. And he had a little, I think it was a 16-foot, might have been 17, glass drum with a walk-through windshield, you know, a little ski boat. And I think we might have had a 40 or 50-horsepower motor on it. So every time we came, you know, we just chugged down there and chugged down there, and we'd finally get there. And we were fortunate enough at the time that we would stay in the cabin. His father-in-law would be there, and there were two more cabins, the Dinklers and Tom Leslie. Tom Leslie he knew as much about the big trout down there as any living human being. Those guys, they all worked for Celanese, and they could fix anything. If you can imagine, back in 1970, they had those three cabins there, and they had a solar system to run their pump for their water well so we could take a semi-fresh shower. And they would tell us where to go, what to do, what was biting, what wasn't biting. So I would say those guys gave us a lot of information that you don't have. Another guy that I also learned a lot from, probably more than anybody else down here, well, Cliff Webb and Doug Bird, but I got to actually fish with Doug a little more than Cliff. Doug Bird recently died this past year, 80 years old. He was like the first guy down here. He's the one that, if you know Baffin, there's a lot of rocks and it's dangerous down there and you can't just go anywhere you want to go. You really have to be careful. And he started out, and I'll tell you a story about him if you want to hear a real story. Back then, they've got these little 16-foot skiffs with a 20-horsepower motor maybe. And they go down there, and he got into the guide business. He was selling used cars at the time, I think. And he got into the guide business because he was go down there by himself, and he was getting the rocks figured out, where he could go, where he couldn't go. And then his buddy would want to go with him. Another buddy would want to go with him. And he told him, he said, look, guys, if I'm going to keep taking you, at least y'all can pay for the gas. And then it got to be where he said, look, I'm just not going to take you anymore because I've got people that want to pay me money to take them. So that's kind of, and he did that for, I guess, 40 years. Anyway, he was as good a fisherman as I've ever known. He went to a tournament in Austin, bass fishing. He fished both sides. In fact, when the brown tide came in, he just quit baffing because he was strictly a lure fisherman. And started bass fishing. Anyway, so I had lived in Austin, and there's bass clubs all over that area, lots of them. They all fish over there at Town Lake and Lake Travis and all that. And so they know that lake like the back of their hand. So Doug called me one day and said, hey, I'm gonna come up to Austin and fish in a bass tournament up there. I said, really? I said, where are you gonna fish? He said, well, I don't know, I've never been there before. He'd never been on the lake. He came up there and won first place in that tournament against all those guys that live there and fish it regularly. I mean, that's how good a fisherman he is. He's phenomenal. He just has a knack for it. And he taught me so much, and where the rocks are and where the rocks aren't. I'd ask him, well, Doug, are there any rocks in here? And he said, well, I've never hit one. He would never tell you that there weren't any rocks in there, because they can be anywhere. And as the tide goes up and goes down, it can get more dangerous. Like with my little shallow sport, right now I could run over top of all the rocks and never even think about being going to hit one. But let that tide drop out a foot, now you're in trouble. So, I would say those people, and Cliff has just been a friend for a long time. And he's the kind of guy that, he always wants to help you. He's always trying to make you have the best day that you've ever had with him. I mean, I've taken my kids with him and my father-in-law and grandparents, you name it, and he'll figure out some way to help them catch a fish.
Hmm. Well, what do you think makes Baffin Bay so special?
God. Really. I mean, he left us just an absolute awesome place where the water was clear, the fish were abundant, and we've kind of squandered some of that. And I think it's time that we get back to where we were. And I think it's possible. I mean, they did it in Florida, Tampa Bay. That was like terrible. They said, and now it's beautiful. So it's something that we can do. It's just we have to put the time and the money in. And the big thing is, I think, is we need to get some of the politics out of it, because a lot of times the Parks and Wildlife will know what the right thing to do, and they'll even recommend, just like with the oyster deal we're going through now. I mean, everybody knows that when you put an extra 100, 200 boats on one little oyster reef, pretty soon there's no oyster reef. So if the Parks and Wildlife and the people, the scientists, can actually make the decision instead of having some politician, because maybe they're getting a donation from somebody else, I think it would be a lot better.
Well, I want to come back to that, kind of what success looks like. But what does Baffin Bay mean to you?
It means that this is where I want to live. I mean, that's pretty strong statement. That's the allure for me to actually make my home here, want to live here, and never want to leave here. It's just, it's a magical place, Jen. I mean, there's so many different opportunities down there that Mother Nature and God have given us, to where you can fish with the whole family down there. You can get out of the boat. You can go wade fish. You can go from here, especially with these new boats and the motors we have and as fast as they'll go. I mean, if you want to go really to Port Mansfield, you can jump in your boat and you go to Port Mansfield. Now, you're going to have to fill up with fuel when you get down there. A lot of people, you know, especially the guides, you know, they can take a whole family fishing with them. They can run down to the land cut, throw in some shrimp, and they're probably going to catch something. You know, they'll catch some drum down there or catch some redfish or trout. You know, now with the new flounder program, I've noticed since that started the last few years, we're seeing more trout, more flounder. You know, until that program got underway, we'd go out and fish. Shoot, we might fish 3 or 4 or 5 trips. And then somebody would catch a flounder and say, wow, that's pretty cool. Somebody caught a flounder. Well, now it seems like, you know, if you're actually fishing for flounder and you go out, you may catch a fish or two today. So, and the rocks are always a kind of a, you know, that's kind of the, I don't know, that's kind of the mystical part, I would say, of Baffin Bay, is they're there. And even the rocks were so important because that's where the fish are going to hang around. And until the development of GPS, you really had to know where you were going and what you were doing. Well, nowadays, everybody has a GPS. Everybody can buy all the tracks to all the places that they want to go for, you know, $500 or $1,000. So now, instead of having some places where you could kind of maybe go and get away from some people, because maybe they wouldn't want to come right in there to that spot because they didn't know exactly how to get there, now they're going to be right there. So instead of you being able to fish a little larger area, and I'm not talking about taking over half the bay or something with you and your buddies, I'm talking about, you know, maybe getting where somebody's not within 100 yards of you or 200 yards from you and actually get out without somebody running across your line with a power boat. You know, I've been fishing on the shoreline, on the south shore, and this is really bad, and was fishing 30 or 40 feet from the shoreline, and a guy in a boat came between me and the shoreline. So I can't really tell you the really bad part about that story. The guy in the boat, I'll tell you, the guy in the boat was in a Parks and Wildlife boat, and I'm going, really? Because it's not like they don't know where they're going. They know they can go out around there. There's no rocks or anything over there. So, but that's, you know, that's, I think that's one of the biggest things, is that people now are just not as considerate as people used to be. And I don't know whether that's from ignorance or intent. Either way, it's unacceptable. Because if people are out wading in the water, you don't want to run through them with your boat. And a lot of people will. They'll come up, hey, how y'all doing? You catching anything? Not anymore. And people are getting increasingly belligerent. You know, like somebody will pull in, and guides included. Some of the guides, you know, they think they own the water. I mean, I'd say a good portion of them think they own it. Well, I've been here, you know. We were wade fishing, guy came in there, and I said, how come y'all are getting so close? Oh, we were here this morning. I said, oh, what time? I hadn't seen anybody in 3 or 4 hours. And he said, well, I'm fishing here. This is one of my spots. And I told him, I said, well, I'm sorry. I really apologize, but, I think I was fishing here before you were born. That's one of the benefits of getting older, You don't have to be really ugly to people, but you can let them know that you don't appreciate what they're doing.
Yeah, that's pretty crazy. So what is your most memorable experience about Baffin Bay?
My most memorable one is the one that I was telling you about that didn't have anything to do with catching a fish. Okay, Doug Bird, the guy that I told you was such a great fisherman, he and his son Clark are coming down here to stay in the cabin. And they want me to come down and stay with them. Okay. I said, okay, where do I meet you? Well, just go in, turn in there by old Chatter Allen's cabin and go down there and we'll be in the blue cabin. And so I said, okay, I'll go down and I'll turn the corner and all the cabins are blue. They're all blue. So I said, he said, well, there's a big post next to it. Okay. So I go over there and I find a cabin, blue cabin. It's got this big creosote post next to it. I said, this has got to be the one. So I pulled in, unloaded all my stuff and put it up on, they'll have kind of a little deck out there. Put all my stuff up on the deck, get out of the boat. And they had been having some problem with their motor. He's got a Lake and Bay and had a motor that was just not really functioning very well. And so I waited and start getting dark. And I said, man, I don't know. I said, I bet they had some problem. And then I said, well, if they did, they got somebody that already went back to, had them taken back. I said, well, I'll go get them. I won't go get them. I won't go get them. Yeah, I'll go get them. And then it was dark. And then a norther hit. Pretty good norther. So I said, well, I'm fine. I know they're fine. So I'm just going to stay here and I'll go back in the morning. If their boat had to be repaired, we can all squeeze in my boat and we'll come down. So I'm sitting there and everybody brought their sleeping bag and their bedroll and pillows and all that. And I had all the food, so I knew they had to come to me. So I go to bed, I lay down on that deck of that thing because the door was locked. Lay down on the deck, get my pillow, get my sleeping bag, and I'm sitting there and sound asleep. My head, what is that? And I wake up and here's this helicopter. And it's going way out there. It's got a big spotlight on, way back over there, way back over there. And this is how dumb I am, Jen. I said, man, somebody must be lost. I went right back to sleep. And then and a little bit later, and I mean, every time they leave, it's like 20 or 30 minutes, they're gone. And then they come back. And then finally, I hear, and I look up and the helicopter's right there. And I'm going, man, I wonder who's lost. Really, it never crossed my mind that they were looking for me at all. Not even one second. So anyway, all of a sudden, I had my boat long line, so it was away from that thing, where that norther wouldn't beat it into the cabin. And so it's out there about 20 feet from the cabin. And all of a sudden, I look up. Here comes this frog, man. The water there is just about waist deep. And those Coast Guard guys, they know every section of that. They know where they can get out, where they can't. Frog man gets out, walks over, and that deck is probably about this high off the water, maybe 2.5 feet. He put his hands on the deck. The next thing I knew, he was standing in front of me. Those guys, you talk about in good shape. He just took one leap, boom. He said, are you Cookie Cooper? I said, yes, sir, I am. He said, are you sure you're Cookie Cooper? I said, yes, sir, I'm sure I'm Cookie Cooper. He said, well, your friends are worried about you. I said, why? He said, well, they thought you got lost or you were down at Yarborough or something like that. And I said, no, I'm fine. I've been waiting for them, but I figured their motor must have broken down because they've been having trouble with that motor. He said, no, in fact, they're right up there about 200 yards. So I said, oh, this is not the right blue cabin. So Clark, Doug Bird's son, gets in the boat, gets in his boat. He comes down there, and I mean, waves are just. He said, "Man, I'm glad you're here. Glad we found you." I said, "Well, I don't know why y'all even called. You know, I'd be all right." They called my son. They called my fishing buddy for 52 years, Bruce McKee. Bruce told him, he said, "Don't worry about Cookie. He's the safest man on the water I know. He's fine." So anyway, he comes down. He said, "Jump in your boat. Get your stuff and come on up here with us." I said, "Clark, it's too rough out here to get my boat, pull it up here, get all this stuff in it, and come up." I said, "Just pull your boat up. I'm going to get my rope, my bedroll and my pillow." And I said, "I'm getting the boat with you. We'll get it in the morning." So we go back, we go up there. And I have to admit, the bed in that cabin they had was a lot more comfortable than that wood plank deck that I was laying on. Anyway, with the internet now, before I even got up in the morning, everybody in the world knew it. See, they don't have to give two names. They don't have to say Cookie Cooper. They just say, "Cookie did this, Cookie did that." And, and of course, the story gets all convoluted, you know, how things happened and what happened. So, anyway, that was my biggest experience. My greatest thrill was right there hanging on the wall. That's a 10.5-pound trout, and it's a replica. I let the trout go. We didn't keep the trout. Although, I have to admit, my buddy Cliff Webb said, "Oh man, you just need to get a real mount on that." I said, "No, we're not getting a real mount. We're letting her go." He said, "Oh well, she might die." I said, "Well, if she does, it's gonna be on her own terms." She was in great shape. She was just hooked in the lip. And that was the biggest thrill I had, because I was with my good buddy Cliff Webb and my son. And I've been buying Cliff Corkies. That's a kind of a big bait around that everybody was trying to get. And I'd always bring a few to Cliff and bring a few to Cliff. And he said, "One of these days I'm going to take you and your boy fishing." So it was just, he called and said, "See if Slade can come down here." He said, "There's some big fish on the shoreline." And I actually caught that fish just right straight across from here. So we didn't even have to go to Baffin. And that was a thrill, basically, because I got to be with my good friend Cliff Webb and my son. I can tell you a funny story about him if you want.
Sure.
Okay. My son, he's a very big conservationist. Like, I tell him, "Slade, why don't you just take a couple homes to your fish to your mom? She doesn't need them." Okay. So anyway, he's got a friend named Jose, Jose was not a fisherman. And Slade kind of started bringing him down here, and Jose got the bug. So he's an avid fisherman now. Anyway, my son's fished with me all of his life. He's 40 years old, and he hasn't caught a 10-pound trout yet. Of course, there's a lot of 70-year-old people haven't caught a 10-pound trout. Anyway, so he and his buddy Jose and another Ben or one of his other buddies came with him, and they're fishing the west end of Tide Gauge Bar. They're lined up there, and sure enough, his buddy Jose catches a 10-pound trout. And my son was so meticulous, he said, because the hook was sideways, getting it out where he didn't even drop, you know, spill a drop of blood, let that trout go. So the generation behind us is a lot more conservation minded, and I think even the guides now, because there's so much on the internet, they're starting to realize that the big thing is not showing a cooler full of dead fish. The big thing is showing the big fish that you let back go. So it's happening, Jen. It's getting better, getting better, getting better. People are more conscious and more wise. I can remember a case where one year we had some winter Texans come down, and they were all kept down there at at the ramp down here. Anyway, they had those sail lines out, and that night a school of giant trout came through. This had been, I guess, back in the 60s, but a giant school of trout came through there, and they caught a ton of them right there. you know, you have the launch at Bird Island, then you kind of have the little area for wind surfing and all that. Well, they were all camped out along there. Back then, you could just camp wherever you want. It didn't matter. Anyway, I caught just umpteen giant trout, 8, 10, maybe bigger, and filleted every one of them. And I don't think that's something that would happen today. Back then, I guess if they had the internet, all those people would have told all their friends, and then all you'd had 2,000 people down there trying to catch one of those fish the next day. Because it's instantaneous now. I mean, they're in the water with their cell phone in their pocket, texting them, "We're here, this is what we caught, here's a picture." And then they wonder why all of a sudden there's 1,000 people there.
So you mentioned your son was conservationist. You just have the one son?
I have one son and one daughter.
Okay, and they grew up fishing with you?
Oh, my son, if he didn't have a 4-year-old and a 7-year-old, would be here more frequently, but he's an appraiser as well, and he's totally inundated with business. I mean, he cannot keep up, literally, and his wife's a nurse. So between the two of them and trying to take care of those two boys, they've got their hands full. It's a real treat for him when he comes down to be able to go fishing. And most of the time, he's a really, really good dad. He's a family guy. When they come down, he's going to stay with the family. He's not going to run off with me, unlike I was. I have to admit, I would come down and run off and go fishing. So I have a lot of respect for him, and they're building a tremendously successful life. But one of these days, I told him, I said, I went through that same thing. You remember, I had two kids to raise too, as well, like you do. Oh, yeah. I said, I know about all that. I know about one of them's going this way, and you're taking one to soccer over there, and the other one's going to softball over here, and you're passing each other going back and forth to town. I said, I know about all that. But in another 10 years, when they get into college, you'll have some time. Mm-hmm. And they won't want to see you after they're 16 anyway.
So did you teach him conservation values growing up, or?
Well, that was always a part of our life, but it's not like now. It's just more intense now. You know, people are, let me put it this way, Jen. We never caught or killed anything that we didn't eat. We didn't just go out there to just decimate the population of any species. And, you know, we had a ranch, and we had deer on it and turkey, and we didn't go out there and kill every turkey or every quail. You know, it was our whole process. Anytime you own land, you're worried about next year and the next year and the next year. A lot of the people that come to the coast, they're just worrying about today, what can I take home? And, you know, I understand that. A lot of people like, you know, fresh fish or whatever, and they get here and they say, well, we want to take as many as we can home. Fortunately, the Parks and Wildlife, since the big freeze, has stepped in. And right now, you know, it used to be trout, the limit was 15 inches, and you couldn't keep anything over 15 inches up to 25 for trout. And the Parks and Wildlife stepped in and said, no, that's too many. So now they've implemented new regulations where you can only keep 3 trout, and they have to be between 17 and 23. That's going to help a lot because that increases the spawning biomass. So I can already see there's a lot of little fish that are in the bays, and they don't have to be 10 pounds to spawn. The little ones spawn too. They just don't spawn as many eggs. But I think in another 2, maybe 3 years that we'll actually have a recovery that's noticeable and substantial. So I'm encouraged. Mm-hmm.
Can you talk more about the changes you've noticed to Baffin Bay over time?
The main change in Baffin Bay is the water quality, because it used to be clear. A friend of mine named Tom Sanders has a cabin right down there where on Laguna Salada, Cayo del Groyo, right where he's probably within a half a mile of Scott Murray's house. You have to drive past his house to get to Scott's house. And he and his son were fishing. He and his son and I were fishing one day at Penascal Point, and we were just drifting along. And this is how clear the water was then. Back then, we just pretty much threw gold spoons. I mean, that was the thing in that area. So we're drifting down. His son Stephen was probably about 10 maybe. And his dad was in the front. Stephen was in the middle standing next, well, he was actually kneeling. They had those ski seats, you know, cushion seats. He was kneeling there and I was standing up. I had my gold spoon on there and I was fixing the cast and I looked down and about 3 feet under the water, you could see this flounder just laying there on a rock. I said, Stephen, watch this. And I pulled that spoon across and that flounder hit it and put the flounder in the boat. And to this day, when I see him, Stephen now is 50, and Stephen will say, you remember that flounder we caught off? We remember that flounder we caught with that gold spoon that was laying on that rock? I said, yeah, I sure do. And that's the biggest change. And, you know, like I said, Doug Bird, whenever the brown tide came, he just left. It was that bad, you know, for years. And it'll be back because, you know, we have so much phosphorus and nitrogen coming off the agricultural activities that are happening around the bay. And I think it seems like when we have a drought, they go away because nothing's running into the bay. But I would predict that sometime in the future, the brown tide will come back again. I mean, it's been here way before this last event we had. You know, there's been a couple other ones even in my lifetime. So that's just part of something nature does. But I think we're helping her do the brown tide by the things we're putting in the water. And there's, you know, a lot of those little cities up there, their septic systems are failing. You've got a lot of septic systems all around the bays. Everything that King Kennedy Ranch don't own. And then the municipal sewer systems are failing, and they're putting raw sewage in the water. I mean, here last year, one of Scott's friends actually took pictures and took them, said, hey, you know, somebody's got to fix this. And that contributes to killing seagrass, and the less seagrass you have, the less trout you have. It's just a vicious cycle. So I think the water clarity is the biggest thing as far as the health of Baffin Bay and the water quality. And as far as the life of Baffin Bay, I think there needs to be a way. Florida does it. They have different areas where they say, okay, we're going to do some different rules here, or we're not going to do this, or we're going to change the limits or the size limits or whatever, to where they're going to have to say, okay, this Baffin Bay is closed, or have a season, okay, where you can fish it after the spawn. But with the fishing pressure we have and with the meteoric growth of Texas in general, you know, a lot of those people coming from California like to fish too. So when you start putting millions more people on those same waters, it just makes for a lot of chaos. And I feel very fortunate that I got to be here when it still was pretty much pristine and there wasn't a lot of traffic. And if you talk to any of the older guys, the septuagenarians and up, they'll tell you that the two biggest things are the traffic and the people that are people, and that people are so inconsiderate. But then with a little work, we can get it back. I mean, well, it's going to take a lot of work and it's going to take a lot of money, but it looks like people are starting to realize what a treasure we have here. I mean, even in Austin, Texas, at the legislature, the governor and those kind of people are starting to say, hey, you know, we've got something really special here. We need to, you know, put some effort into keeping it what it used to be or getting it back to what it used to be.
What do you think success looks like in terms of restoring it back to what it used to be?
Success to me would be if I can run into Baffin Bay and it's clear again. That's success.
What about the fishing?
We get the bay cleaned up. I think the fishing will take care of itself. And like I say, if they'll leave it to the scientists and let the Texan Park and Wildlife step in and say, we need to do this or we need to do that, it's just infuriating to know that the oyster fishing was poor in Louisiana, so all those oyster boats came over here to Texas. It's just like the bay. We can or fishing in the bay. We can support our local oyster boats, but when you put another two or three times that much on those same little oyster reefs, pretty soon there's no oyster reefs. And the biologists know it. I mean, the people at the Hart Foundation, they know what's going on over there. And they stopped it. And then all of a sudden, for whatever reason, they said, oh, no, no, we're not going to do that. We're going to leave it open for Mesquite and Carlos and all those bays up there. So if we can get the politics out and let the people that make the decisions be scientists and people that fish down here. I mean, those guides know. They know when it's not right. They know when it's going down. You ask a Cliff Webb or like when Doug Bird used to be there, they can tell you what's going on a lot better sometimes than even the scientists. And a guy like Scott Murray, I guarantee you he can tell you what's going on back there at Cayo del Gordo as well as anybody that doesn't have a microscope.
How do you think we can get younger generations to want to be stewards of Baffin Bay?
I think it's already happening. I mean, if you look at the internet and you look at these people, even the guides are starting to get a little antsy about showing a big box of fish because they know that the people coming up, they're not into that. They want to. People don't come back. People don't come down. I can say in the past, people actually came down here to get some fish to go home and feed their families. That's not the case anymore. These people come down here for the experience of being out on the water with a good guide. They can let them catch a fish or two or three and let them go. Because it's just as much thrill. It was more thrill in that letting that fish go, even than catching it, just seeing her swim off. Well, that's another story I'll tell you. Okay, so my son, he must have taken 20 pictures. They measured it, got the girth, all that. Let her go, and I had a big smile on my face. End the story. So, like 3 months later, maybe four, my son calls me. Slade says, Dad, you got a package coming today. You need to be home. I said, okay. So I was going to be home, and they bring a crate, you know, it's like 2 feet by 2 feet by 3 feet long. I open it up, and that's what was in it, that 10.5-pound trout replica. I had no idea that anybody was doing it or anything, but what happened, my friend Bruce McKee, he was fortunate enough, they found some pretty nice oil on his place. And he had a little extra money, and he's such a good friend that he called my son. He said, Slade, if you can figure out how to get one of those replicas made, he said, I'll pay for it. I have no idea what they cost. I don't want to know. Anyway, so Slade found somebody in Florida, and at first they sent him pictures and back and forth. And he said, no, that's too green. Do this. That needs to be done. And when they finally got it done, it pretty realistic. So that's how that ended up on my wall up there, and I'm very proud of it. And it was a very kind thing from my friend, I call him Dr. Bruce McKee, he did do. And my son did his part too to get it all to have it all come together.
Cool.
Anyway, I think everybody's aware now in Baffin Bay of some of the sources of the pollution. Some of them are easily fixed if they just, you know, put the dollars in there. I mean, to redo a sewer plant. I think Scott may have said something about they may have gotten a state grant for one of the sewer plants, maybe at Revere or something. I'm not sure about that, Jen, but everybody's aware of it now. So the environmental organization in Texas is not going to let them continue to put raw sewage into the Baffin Bay. So that'll be resolved. And just, it's a little by little thing. It's not like you're going to walk out there and all of a sudden it's going to be great. But I feel very comfortable with my son and his friends and their friends, all his whole universe of people that he knows, they're all committed to giving some of this to their kids. Where in the past, you know, everybody just fished. Well, there was somebody you didn't have to worry about because it's always been there. We just didn't have enough people to decimate the supply. And now we do.
Well, that's all the questions I have. Do you have any more fish stories?
No, I just... can't think of any right now. I probably have some fish stories, but they'd probably be fish stories.
Well, is there anything else you'd like to add about your life or Baffin Bay or conservation efforts?
All I have to add is I think we're on the right trail. And it's like I texted Scott back yesterday. It was the other day when he sent me that video of John Sutton and him and all those other old timers. I texted him. I said, "We can do it." Oh, I said, "We can do this." And he texted me back, "Yes, we can." And it's been one of his life's ambitions to get things back because he knows what it was like. See, a lot of the people that fish now don't have any clue how good Baffin Bay was. They think it's good now. And if we would just give it a little tender, loving care, it could be fabulous. And like I say, more and more people, you don't see guides throwing out there a big ice chest full of fish because people actually get mad about that. And then they start telling their friends, "Oh, don't mess with him, don't mess with him." And even the tournaments, like the tournaments used for like the Legends tournament, they used to run the tournament where you had to bring the fish in to weigh. Well, they keep them alive. They have live wells, big live wells, all these tournament trout fishermen, and they keep them alive, but you know, a certain portion of them are going to die for sure because they get extra points if they're alive. Well, they finally figured out, now they have a new system, and I think it's just wonderful that Chad Petterick, who's running the Legends tournament, gets in there. They've got these scales now where all they do is when they catch a fish, they put it on that scale, and it evidently, Jen, has the time, the date, the weight, everything else, and then they let the fish go right there. So that's really nice. So, and he was, you know, he would put in many fish in the ice box as he could too, but even Chad's changing. Everybody's changing. So I think the guide, Jay Watkins is a real good example. Jay Watkins, you know, he was the picture man, put up a big picture, show all the fish he could catch. Well, in the last 3 or 4 years, he's kind of got his clientele conditioned to where we're going to go try to catch some fish. We're not going to load the ice chest, and you're going to have a good time. And I have to mention, the guy that's really been fighting the fight is a guy named David Rousey. He's a guide down here. And David has been trying to tell everybody to remember the buffalo forever. And it's finally taken hold. I think, and I'm a lure fisherman. I'll say it right up front. We don't use bait. I used to. I mean, you know, when I used to fish a long time ago. But I haven't used bait in 2 or 3 decades. Anyway, I know everybody has a right to catch a fish however they want to catch it. But I think if they eliminated croaker fishing, for one thing, it would eliminate a lot of guides, because there's a lot of people that fish, they're guides, part-time guides, whatever. And a trout just cannot resist a croaker. They're going to eat it. And we never had, when people used to fish with shrimp all the time, we never had any big problems with the stock, you know, their trout stocking and their numbers or anything else. They always caught plenty of fish, but with croakers, they're catching bigger, more spawning fish, and more fish. But, and on top of that, in the old days, those croaker that they're using for bait, if they didn't scratch them all up off the bottom and use them for bait, would eventually turn into a croaker like that, you know, maybe 16, 18 inches long. We used to catch them in the surf, and people used to eat them. But they aren't there anymore because they get them all out of the bay. So that would be one thing. If I had the power, I would eliminate croakers as a bait fish and put them back, or put them to a sport fish where they couldn't use them. Because then the kids could catch them when they were a little bigger out in the surf or in the bays. They used to be everywhere. And if they keep up, they'll eventually deplete that supply where there won't be any croakers. Because so many, we have only so many of any species. And whenever people start attacking that species, like the buffalo, we can put them into extinction. I don't care what species it is, human beings included.
Anything else?
I don't know, Jen. They're just stories. I think you kind of know where I'm coming from, and I think I'm very encouraged about, you know, the people behind us, because they are extremely conservation minded, and that may be our salvation. Maybe we have to get rid of all of us old septuagenarians. But never did any of us take more fish than we were going to feed our family. We didn't go fishing with a guide, put 10 pounds of fillets in the freezer and throw them out the next year because they were freezer burned. And a lot of people are doing that. I mean, we know that. I mean, people tell, oh yeah, I had to throw one that caught last year out. So, but there's hope. And I'm a very optimistic person.
Well, I think that's a great place to stop then. Thank you. Turn this off.